sempre comigo, memórias de um fado antigo.
The Lollipop Guild only listens to WGXC Acra 90.7 FM.
I'll have some clam chowder followed by beefsteak on rye, pumpkin pie, whipped cream and coffee.
Hi, this is Phyllis Segura, host of Eating It in the Hudson Valley, a monthly program about anything food-related, like farmers, recipes, local products, and permaculture. I'll feature interviews, my monthly food report, and more. Tune in on the second Tuesday of the month from 2 to 3 in the afternoon on WGXC 90.7 FM or online at WGXC.org.
I want a green salad on the side. Don't forget the French fried pizza pie, garlic and anchovy.
Are you looking for a child development program for your preschooler? Columbia Opportunities Head Start offers full-day early childhood development activities and support to eligible 3- and 4-year-olds throughout Columbia County at no cost to families. School readiness, health, nutrition, and parent engagement activities are offered throughout the year. Head Start classrooms are located in Hudson, Philmont, Taconic Hills, Volusia, and Chatham. Give your child a head start. For more information, 518-828-6312. Or ColumbiaOpportunities.org.
WGXC underwriting support is provided by Scribner's Catskill Lodge, a 38-room boutique hotel located in Hunter, offering a seasonal outdoor pool, weekend wellness programming, and nightly s'mores around the fire pits. Located at 13 Scribner Hollow Road, across the street from Hunter Mountain, 8 miles from the forest trails in Catskill Park, and 22 miles from the town of Woodstock. Scribner's is also home to the Prospect Restaurant and Bar serving modern fare. Information at 518-628-5130 or at www.scribnerslodge.com.
Good afternoon and welcome to Purple House. I'm your host, Robert Tomlinson. You're listening to WGXC, your local community radio station, 90.7 FM. Today we have an exciting show planned. We have four live musicians in the studio who are actually giving us a little bit of a preview of what's going to happen tomorrow night at Hilo at 8 o'clock. It's a couple of different things we're celebrating, but the focus is going to be on William Blake's Songs of Innocence and Songs of Experience. And let me introduce our guests first before we go further into that. We have Steve Taylor. Steve Taylor is a writer-musician based in Brooklyn. For 20 years, he collaborated on poetry and music with Allen Ginsberg. He's been with the Fugs for 3 decades. He's the author of False Prophets, Field Notes from the Punk Underground, and is the editor of Don't Hide the Madness, William S. Burroughs' Conversation with Allen Ginsberg, forthcoming from Three Rooms Press. And I hope we're going to talk a little bit about that. Welcome, Stephen. Thank you for being here. Also, we have in the studio Mr. Brian DeWan playing accordion. Everyone knows who Brian is locally. He's a visual artist and musician living in Catskill. He's played with the Raymond Scott Orchestra, Flaming Fire, Jesse Ray, and David Byrne. He drew the Flying Victrola for the Neutral Milk Hotel album, The Aeroplane Over the Sea, and drew the album cover for the Boston Typewriter Orchestra. He currently has an art exhibit at the Stevenson Library at Bard College. Welcome, Brian.
Hello.
We also have Ross Goldstein. Hello, Ross.
Hi.
Ross was born 1970 in New York City, lives in Catskill. He's a composer, musician, photographer, member of the psychedelic rock band Devin, Gary, and Ross, a.k.a. Fog Window. And Cecil Hooker. Welcome, Cecil. It's so great to have you here in the studio. I know I just met Cecil yesterday during the rehearsal at Scott Petito's studio. And I know that Cecil's a former member of Snuff and Trapezoid. He'll be playing strings. Hello, Cecil. Welcome.
How are you?
It's great to have you here.
Thank you.
And also, yeah, let's give a shout out to Scott, who can't make it today, but Scott is the one who is actually responsible for making this happen for me, and I am grateful, and I was able to sit in for about 45 minutes yesterday's rehearsal, and hopefully we'll have time to play a little bit of that. Before we jump into what's happening tomorrow night, let's do a little bit of an individual thing. Should we do that? Cecil, what are you up to? What's happening with you? What's new in the last few months? What do you have coming up?
I just recently moved up here to this area, and
about a year anyway. I've been playing music. I do video as a trade, and I have a band called Too Many Lauras, and we have a new CD coming out. It's called Living in Sin.
All right, thank you. When will it be out?
Well, it's in the presses now. It's vinyl and CD.
Okay, so very soon.
Very soon.
All right. Ross, you have a recent, CD that's out. What are you working on? What's going on?
Well, I've been working on more recordings, new recordings, and I have another record that's coming out of instrumental music in October. And that's primarily what I've been working on the last year or so.
And where are you recording it?
I record in Kingston mostly.
In Kingston mostly?
At a friend's
yeah.
place.
Cool.
Lone Pine Road Studios, my friend Eli.
Oh, nice.
He's a great sound engineer.
All right.
Yeah.
Thank you. Mr. Dewan in the back corner.
Hey there.
Hi.
It's nice in the corner.
It's nice in the corner. So what's up with you? What are you working on?
Well, I'm going to do a show of film strips down at Bard College. I'm still waiting to find out what time, but that's on the 14th, a week from now, Tuesday the 14th.
Tuesday the 14th.
And I know the Stevenson Library, where it's likely to be, closes at 7, so it'll probably be in the late afternoon.
Okay.
So I know it doesn't do you much good, but Tuesday I'll show film strips.
How wonderful. Thank you. Steve?
I've just been recording these William Blake songs with Scott Petito at NRS in Catskill. We did that a few one-week shots over the winter, and there are now 35 Blake songs on tape. And those are mostly William Blake's songs of innocence and experience as set by Allen Ginsberg, who started to set them to music in 1968. And Allen always wanted me to finish the set, and so 20 years after I made him that promise, I'm doing it.
That's great.
And then we just finished the Don't Hide the Madness book, which I've been sitting on for so long, and finally we got it out.
So let's talk about this in detail, because this is really not only historically important, but fascinating to me. So Allen Ginsberg went to Lawrence, Kansas to meet with Burroughs in 1992.
That's correct.
Spent 5 days?
Yeah.
And what happened?
And he recorded a dozen 90-minute cassettes of conversations. So breakfast table, dinner table, a visit to the shooting range, and also, friends and neighbors and assistants coming and going, and really talking about their whole history of their relationship. Because several things happened. One was that some Japanese journalists who were doing a big story for a magazine sent a list of questions for William and Allen. And Allen read the questions, and then they would have these long conversations. So things like, when did you first meet? So he actually talks about, 1943, Christmas, going down to the village and meeting Burroughs at Dave Kammerer's place, and going through the whole history of their relationship, all the way, the whole thing, And then also a couple of interesting things happened. William always felt that he was possessed by a demon. So the arrival, the day that Allen arrived, coincides with an exorcism of that demon, which Brian Geisen, who had collaborated for many years with William on art projects, Brian Geisen named it the ugly spirit. So the beginning of the visit was the exorcism of the ugly spirit with a Navajo shaman called Melvin Betzeli, who did a sweat lodge exorcism, pretty dramatic ceremony involving William and Allen and several friends. And so then there's Allen took copious notes, as was his habit. Mm-hmm. After the ceremony, he went and wrote everything down that he remembered in great detail. So that's the beginning of the book, is Allen's notes on the exorcism. And then there's a follow-up visit with the shaman and much discussion of the work that he did in his regular practice, so there's a lot of that. And then there's a long discussion.
Is there anything with Burroughs responding to the experience after it happened?
Oh, yeah.
And I'm sure that's insightful.
Friends, the friends sitting around the table, and then right. Melvin, the shaman, comes and visits the next day to follow up and make sure everybody's okay. And so then lots of questions and answers and discussion with, all of the participants relaying their memories of the ceremony. And then at the end of the book, just as Alan is getting ready to leave to go back to New York City, William reads from his psychiatrist's notes. He had been he had seen a series of psychiatrists beginning in the early 1940s about his various difficulties. The interesting thing about seeing a shrink in New York City in 1943 is that you're getting a disciple of Freud. They all ran away from Austria.
Yeah.
So there are all these Viennese doctors, quite distinguished, and he had worked with several of them, one of whom, Dr. Wolberg, gave him hypnosis and hypnotherapy, narcotherapy, where William was chained to the couch because, you know, as he says, well, there's a great danger that the patient might attack the doctor. and given hypnosis and the dentist, nitrous oxide.
Yes.
Nitrous oxide. And so there's a long account. The doctor's actual notes, clinical notes from those sessions, have not been published, but were in the possession of James Grauerholtz, who was and is, or who was, William's secretary. And so James gives Alan, the psychiatrist's notes. Alan gives them to William, and William's, what's this? And starts to read aloud his notes of his psychiatrist from the 40s, talking about his various difficulties.
In 1992. So almost 50 years later.
50 years later, they're reading aloud from the shrink notes. And that's sort of the end of the book. And Alan's estate provided me with the photographs. Because, you know, Ginsberg was an avid photographer, and he took a lot of pictures during the visit. Mm-hmm. So those are also in there.
Great. So Three Rooms Press is publishing this?
Yeah,
we anticipate October.
Yeah.
Okay, well, I hope you'll come back. Please,
yeah, sure,
and we'll talk
sure.
more
yeah.
about it. Maybe we can even work on an exhibition for this.
Okay, cool.
Sounds like a great project. And for those who don't know William Blake, we should just say that Blake was an English poet, painter, etcher, printmaker. I should say date. So born November of 1757 and died in August of 1827. Not really that well known in his time. I mean, he had a local reputation, but not
yes.
really well known. Later.
Yes. It was during the Victorian era, really, that he became respected as an unusual case in that, well-respected in two media, in painting or visual art mm-hmm. and poetry.
Mm-hmm. And I think it's also, he's closely identified as kind of a mystic spiritual artist,
yes.
right? I mean, you don't really think of him as just a painter, or just a poet. There's this deep underlying, very important spiritual aspect to who he is and having visions.
Yes, even as a child, he told his mother that he had seen God looking in the window. He was frightened by God looking mm-hmm. in the window and ran to her. And later when he was able to take walks outside the neighborhood and go out into the fields, he saw angels in the trees and he saw spirits moving among the workers in the fields and was quite frank about this his whole life. Mm-hmm. He told his friend Crabb Robinson that he'd visited with Mr. Shakespeare, who of course had been dead for several hundred years by that point. And Mr. Robinson said, "What, William, you're an artist. If you visited Shakespeare, why did you not make a portrait?" And Blake said, "Well, the existing portraits are quite adequate." So, look, real visionary, and
yeah.
In a very, very turbulent time of war, the militarization of the city. He was arrested on two occasions. Censorship. But radicalism, revolution.
So all of this could describe Allen Ginsberg as well.
Well, yeah.
I mean, there's an interesting parallel here.
That's true. And Allen had identified very closely with Blake. In 1948, out of college, Allen had a big hallucination of William Blake, mm-hmm. hearing the voice of Blake, and realizing that the work of the artist is a kind of time machine. In other words, Blake is still with us. He's right there. On the table in front of me. Yeah.
So why do you think so many artists since the Victorian era have admired Blake's work? What's the compelling engagement for so many, not just musicians, visual artists, poets, engravers? What is it about him that's so special?
Well, if you're looking for tattoos, he's your man.
Okay.
No, but the imagery, yeah. the mysticism, the whole cosmology, the prophetic books, the politics, the unusual religious ideas, the belief in free love, what became known as the free love movement, support of women artists, friendship with Mary Wollstonecraft, mm-hmm. And Godwin, and many of the radical artists of his day, moving in sort of feminist circles, literary circles, religious or radical circles. And some of those people had some pretty far out ideas, like there is no God but the man Jesus. You know, things.
Yeah,
like
this is a Blake concept.
This is a concept. It wasn't his words, but it was in the literature, and he was inspired by that.
Yeah. So, do you see a line between? I'm going to draw this and tell me if you think it's wrong. Blake, Baudelaire, Rambo, Walt Whitman, William Carlos Williams, Allen Ginsberg. Is that a poet's family tree? Is that
sure? Yeah, they're all in the lineage.
Yeah. And Ginsberg was a huge fan of all of those poets.
Yes.
That we just mentioned.
Yes, and the idea, you know, in the Romantic period, he's considered an early Romantic now, mm-hmm. but the whole idea that you can change the world with art, or as Ginsberg put it, a change of poem is a change of mind.
Mm-hmm.
This is a whole change of consciousness that comes with a new artistic vision. Mm-hmm. And that really begins with for the modern period, that begins with Blake and the Romantics.
So Blake was known to sing his poems.
He was known to sing his poems. We don't know which ones he sang.
I was going to ask you if there's any record of what he did or how we might know that.
No, one of his friends had kept diaries, and there was a lady called Harriet Matthew, the wife of a minister, a prominent minister, who was a patroness of the arts, and she had the blue stockings, the feminists of the period would come to her place, and all the sort of outsider artists and sort of fringy intellectual characters in the sciences and the academia who were not mainstream recognized people at that point would gather at her place weekly for a salon, and he was a regular attendee at that salon for some years, and he sang. The diarists say he sang his poems at her salon, that he had a fine voice, and the tunes were really lovely, and the tunes were so nice that professor musicians notated the tunes at the party.
Mm.
But we don't know where those
notes are. We don't have a record of it. And do you think that's why Ginsberg started singing them?
No, Ginsberg started to sing them because he heard them in his... He was... in 1968, Allen was at the Chicago Democratic Convention, which was a big police riot, mm-hmm. where the police basically beat the hell out of everybody. And Ginsberg witnessed that, and he was completely horrified by it. And on his way back, on the Greyhound bus, to his place in Cherry Valley, near Cooperstown...
Mm-hmm.
He heard a voice in his ear singing, "Vain the sword and vain the bow, they never shall work war's overthrow," which is a line from, I think, Jerusalem.
Mm.
And so he got home to Cherry Valley, and he had a pump organ in his place, and he sat down and he told me he sat up 48 hours setting the poems to music. So we don't know which songs Blake sang, but we do know that he published a book called Songs, and they sing pretty good.
Now, did that precede Songs of Innocence and then Songs of Experience, or did it become it?
In 1789, he published Songs of Innocence, and then 5 years later, he published Songs of Experience and put them together. So the final book was Songs of Innocence and of Experience, showing the two contrary states of the human soul.
And might I suggest, if you have the chance, be sure to look at them in the context in which he made them,
yeah.
which is to look at them. He placed his words in the context of artwork.
Yes.
He did not feel that the poems should be just by, the words should be by themselves on the page. There was an integration of the visual and the text.
Yes, but there was a practical reason behind that. And that was initially Mrs. Matthew and her husband had paid for him to publish Poetical Sketches, which was a conventional printed mm-hmm. book of poems.
Mm-hmm.
But after that, he sort of fell out of favor because of his, he was not very good at conversation. He was good at preaching. And so in a sort of middle class salon setting, he became a little tiresome. So he kind of fell from favor with Mrs. Matthew and that crowd. But his brother Robert, who had died, mm-hmm. appeared to him as a spirit and told him, "William, you know, you can use your engraver's art to make your books. You don't need to purchase type. You don't need to pay a printer. You can't afford it anyway, but you already have the tools." And so he actually would engrave the, etch the words by hand and little illustrations on plates, copper plates, and then he and his wife Catherine would print them. And he and she would color them. So each book each edition
was handmade.
Is handmade, and they're all different.
Right.
The color schemes are all different.
And we should probably explain in the context, too, that Blake, as a young adolescent, was sort of pushed into this idea of getting a trade.
Yeah.
And he got into engraving, and he became a master engraver. It was
yes.
a great skill set for him.
Yes.
And ended up working really well for what he wanted to do, to find his own voice
yes.
and bring it
he
out to the world.
He also had a great taste for the Gothic. And so the etching of the hand etched pages resemble to some extent the old handwritten Bibles that were done by monks and decorated with little illustrations. So this new method of engraving, which he invented actually, allowed him to indulge in his taste for the Gothic.
Oh, wonderful. Let's hear a song. Are we ready? What are we going to hear first?
Let's do the introduction to the Songs of Innocence.
Songs of Innocence.
I'll give you two bars.
Everybody ready?
Okay, here we go. Piping down the valleys wild, piping songs of pleasant glee. On a cloud I saw a child, and he laughing said to me, pipe a song about a lamb. So I piped with merry cheer, piper, pipe that song again. So I piped, he wept to hear, drop thy pipe, thy happy pipe, sing thy songs of merry cheer. So I sang the same again, while he wept with joy to hear, piper, sit thee down and write in a book that all may read. So he vanished from my sight, and I plucked a hollow reed, and I made a rural pen, and I stained the water clear, and I wrote my happy songs every child may joy to hear.
That's so sweet. So let's talk about process. So you have a written text.
Yeah.
We don't really know how Blake gave it a melody.
Yeah.
You have some ideas about how Alan did, because you were there. You
yeah.
worked with him on this whole process.
Yeah.
So are you really using what you developed with Alan as the basis of this?
Or no, this is what Alan wrote.
This is what he wrote.
Because
you did some of them yourself.
I did, later,
okay.
much later.
So this is one that Alan wrote.
So this is one that Ginsberg wrote, starting at the beginning of the whole collection with the introduction to the Songs of Innocence. And he was able to notate melodies, but he wasn't able to notate rhythm. it's like medieval music. Little dots on the page. So he worked with a really great bunch of musicians and made a record that was released on Fantasy Records in like 71 or 72.
Uh-huh.
A selection of these. And I've got the original charts.
You have the original charts?
From the recording session.
Right.
So very precise notations by actual musicians of what he was doing. So that's what I'm working from.
I want to ask a question for all four of you to participate in if you're interested. And the question is, do you think that we had music before we had language?
It's not for me to say.
Ross is shaking his head. Rod, what do you think? No?
Well, there was hollering and grunting before there was language.
There was hollering and grunting, yes, before there was language.
And that's music.
And that is music.
Well, Darwin said we did.
Yeah, I was thinking about this, especially after the rehearsal yesterday, that there's a way of us being together. And David Smith always wondered if drawing came before language. But he was a visual artist, and he thought, you know, we made marks to kind of develop some sort of code as a way of communicating. And I'm sure some of this is based around safety and finding food and...
Territory, bird
territory.
Song.
Yeah, bird song. Yeah.
Bird song. Is it music?
Is it music, yeah. Huh. Does anyone here... dream in music?
No. Sometimes.
Yeah?
Occasionally, yeah.
See, so tell me about it. What's...
Well,
what's
I mean, I don't know. I mean, when I think of music, it's more like... it's an international language. It's like something that somebody that's from Japan or somebody from Russia or somebody from China, they can understand it. It's not like, you know, you have to talk to them in their language. It is their language.
It is a language.
And it might be slightly different because of different, you know, structural norms, but it's basically a language. And, you know, a lot of times I'll be doing in dreams where I'll be doing visual stuff with music coming in.
Brian?
The only musical dream I can remember right now is one where I thought I heard just the most beautiful music, and when I woke up I remembered what it was, and what it was a choir singing one note like this.
and then the rest of the choir joined in another note, a major second above, and that was the music.
And you recognized that during the dream? You cognitively realized what was going on?
No, when I woke up,
I
remembered it, uh-huh. And then I was in a position to tell you about it.
That's pretty cool.
But I wasn't thinking of how to describe it in the dream. I was just hearing it in the dream.
So I want to talk about certainty and uncertainty as it pertains to making music. So not counting composers like, say, John Cage or Morton Feldman, but most music has a sense of structure. Collection of notes within a definitive measure, et cetera, et cetera. I guess 12 Bars of Blues would be a good example of that. But how does that certainty, that structure, provide support in a positive way and or in a negative way that might actually undermine a composition for you in terms of how you make your music?
Gee, I'm already scheming about how to undermine a composition, but I can't figure out how to do it.
So I guess what I'm saying is, after all the years, because all of you are accomplished composers, singer-songwriters, so after all the years of making music, is there just sort of a flow? Like, I know as a visual artist, you just go in the studio and you go to work. But do you think that that experience of thinking of music in a specific structure sometimes interferes with creating something new? Does that happen?
Well, I can remember, you know, you mentioned Morton Feldman.
Yeah.
He wrote, "Used to be you liked a piece of music because you liked it. Now you gotta have a system." And that pissed him off.
Yeah, he was sort of completely unsystemized, wasn't he?
Well, I mean, he certainly had a lot of theoretical ideas too, but to him that wasn't where the action was. And he felt like what he wanted to do in music was more like what painters wanted to do.
Uh-huh.
And that they were freer to be subjective.
I know he was close friends with John Cage and the group, but I often think of his music and Jackson Pollock as sort of a boundary expanding kind of artist.
Fair enough. He certainly was, you know, into Jackson Pollock and the abstract expressionists, and he felt akin to what they were doing. And then even as much as he knew and loved Cage, he was saying, you know, composers today have abandoned sound. Even John Cage has gone conceptual like everybody else.
So Steve, when you sit down to do a composition, either for yourself or if you're going to adapt something of Blake, can you walk us through that? Is there a sort of a system that happens for you and how that
evolves? Well, if it's
evolves?
A song, I get the words first.
Yeah.
That's just me.
So when you write your own material, do you do the words first?
Yes,
is that generally where it starts? Always the words first. Okay.
And then if it's, say, I've been working with a dance company for the last few years, Douglas Dunn and Dancers in New York, and Douglas will tell me something. He hears a structure or he hears a timbre, or he'll say, like, can you write a piece of Baroque music? To which I foolishly answered yes. But it's always, for me, it's always, I need some kind of a structure to begin with. That was why it was great working with poets like Allen or Ed Sanders or Tully Kupferberg from the Fugs, mm-hmm. or Kenward Elmslie from the New York School, because the poets have some idea. You know, they have the words, or they have some idea of how they want it to sit. And I find myself, I'm very conventional. I mean, I go very conventional on structure.
But I also noticed in the studio, only my one time of watching you rehearse, you're really, I want to say the word really a professional. It sounds so funny to put it like that. But you're really specific about what you want and what you're after. It seems like you're very clear.
Well, you try to leave it as open as possible for the players. But in our case, we've only played together. This is the second time we played together.
Yeah. Yeah.
So I try to get it as tight as I can on the page, mm-hmm. and some idea of what I'm doing, and then open it up from there. But that's just because, you know, if we had been playing together for 15 years, I mean, you know, it'd be different.
Yeah, sure.
Yeah.
Can we hear another song?
Let's do The Shepherd.
Sure.
The Shepherd, okay. This is from Songs of Experience or Innocence?
So this is Songs of Innocence, and it's the second song. It's very short. I guess I'll do it twice. We're going to do it twice. How sweet is the shepherd's sweet love.
From the morn to the evening he strays. He shall follow his sheep all the day. And his tongue shall be filled with praise. For he hears the lamb's innocent call. And he hears the ewe's tender plough. He is watchful while they are in peace, for they know when their shepherd is nigh. How sweet is the shepherd's sweet law. From the morn to the evening he strays. He shall follow his sheep all the day. And his tongue shall be filled with praise. For he hears the lamb innocent call, and he hears the ewe's tender reply. He is watchful while they are in peace, for they know.
Isn't that lovely? Thank you. So you're listening to WGXC 90.7, your local community radio station. I'm your host, Robert Tomlinson. This is Purple House, a monthly forum for the arts. Wow. So let's say, remind people, we're listening to Cecil Hooker on violin, Brian Dewan on accordion, Ross Goldstein on keyboards, Steve Taylor on guitar and vocals.
Thanks.
Thank you. Thank you. That was lovely. So, Steve, when did you and Alan meet? Do you remember your first meeting?
Yeah. Who could forget? I was in college in New Jersey, and I had a friend who was an English professor. I wasn't taking his classes, but we sort of became friends.
And may I ask, what year are we?
1976.
Okay.
And Alan at the time was, he basically made his living gigging, because he, you know, poets don't make a lot of money. So he floated his operation and his little home office and his apartment and everything by touring and playing college gigs in the United States. So he would go to a college with his little harmonium, and he would ask an English professor to find him a guitar player, is basically the thing. So he started to play Blake, and I grew up with Blake.
Really?
Yeah.
Well, okay, hold on. Let's pause right there. How in the world did you grow up with Blake?
Well, I was born in England, and I spent my childhood in England.
So it's part of your elementary school education?
He's in the clouds.
Yeah. I thought he was here on the table.
Yeah, he's there too. He's everywhere.
Okay.
Yeah, the divine image.
So Blake was discussed in your childhood education. Is that what you're saying?
Well, Jerusalem is a big hymn, sort of big national hymn.
Right.
And I had a kind of uncle who was a fan of Blake. So Blake was there. I knew these. And so when he started singing, I was right there. And I was watching his hand on the keyboard so that I could cop the changes. I started to sing. And he'd never had anybody sing with him before.
You were harmonizing him.
I was harmonizing him, and he got very excited.
That's great.
His voice, whenever he got excited, I later learned, whenever his singing voice got a pronounced vibrato, that meant he was very turned on. Mm-hmm. And so after the show, he said, "Don't leave." And then a week later, Everything changed because I suddenly, the first time I was ever in a recording studio in my life was with John Hammond at CBS Records.
Welcome to recording.
Welcome to recording.
Did you know who Alan was at the time? Had you heard of him?
Yeah, I had read his work. I was a big Kerouac fan as a kid. Okay. And I knew Ginsberg and I knew Howell. So when he showed up, yeah, I was ready.
And the teacher said, he needs a guitarist. You said, I'm there.
And here we are. Yeah. And so really, the only conversation we had was, go get your guitar. And then the next thing, we were together on stage singing William Blake.
And you started harmonizing.
I started harmonizing it.
And he got excited.
He got excited.
He says, don't leave.
He says, don't leave. And he said, call me. So my parents were living in North Jersey, not far from where his father was and his stepmother. So I started to visit him.
He was born in Jersey.
Yeah, he's a Patterson kid.
Yeah. Patterson.
So I started visiting him, and we would start doing little tours around. And then there was a kind of a band.
So you're like 18, 19, 20?
I was 21.
21, okay.
And then we had Arthur Russell, who many of your listeners might know Arthur Russell, but he was a bass player. He played cello. He's a wonderful cellist and songwriter who's having a big renaissance now.
Mm.
But he was like our bass player. And then
he's still alive?
Arthur died during the AIDS crisis.
No.
Yeah.
Sorry.
But yeah, but I suddenly, from being this sort of little-known musician on the Lower East Side, I suddenly am like, wait a minute, they're making movies about this guy now. And I'm hearing his music in the coffee shops,
Right.
As things happen like that. So we made that. We made a record with John Hammond.
On the Songs of Innocence.
No, different, what did he call it? I can't even remember it anymore. But CBS didn't want to put it out. Hammond made this record, and then Columbia said, and so the gossip I heard was, oh, Ginsberg, when are you going to stop shaking your butt around? Because he had songs about being gay, all of these things in the 70s that were like, major labels are not going to put that out.
So you met Alan early in your life, and you formed a bond.
Yeah.
And that stayed.
Yeah, I worked with him 21 years.
And at what point did you join the Fugs in that sequence?
So one day, maybe 82 or 83, Ed would know because he has all this memorized, but one day, 82 or 83, Al and I were walking
around. So that references to Ed Sanders, co-founders of the Fugs.
Co-founder of the Fugs.
1964?
Yes.
Thank you.
So Al and I were walking around the village, and he said, the Fugs are rehearsing at 1 Fifth Avenue. Let's go. Let's crash the rehearsal. So it wasn't the Fugs.
Did you know who the Fugs were?
Yeah, I did.
Okay.
From being a kid.
Yeah.
So we went to this nice apartment, and it was Ed as had put together a little group because there was going to be a show at the Mud Club. And Ed was on the bill, and Thule was on the bill as a separate act.
As a separate act?
Yeah.
So they weren't together in the band yet?
No, the band had broken up in 67 or
right,
so.
Right, yeah.
68. So
so they were all pursuing separate solo careers.
Solo careers.
Okay.
And, writers. Being writers.
Yeah.
So we went, and there was Kobe Batty, who is now, has been with the Fugs as long as I have.
Percussionist.
And Ed always carries with him copies of the lyrics. So when you crash the rehearsal, he hands you the lyrics. So I've got the lyrics. So they started singing, how sweet I roam from field to field. And take a taste it all, the summer's pride, right?
Yeah.
Which is a Blake song. So then Kobe started to harmonize it. So then I put a third harmony on it.
Mm-hmm.
And the agent who had been working with the Fugs, Charlie Rothschild, was there. And he said, you guys should do something.
And so Scott's not there yet.
No, Scott was a couple of years later.
Okay.
And so then I started coming up to Woodstock to work on music with Ed. And I would come up to his house, and we would sit in the garden and make poems into songs and stuff. And then in 84, he said, Ronnie Reagan's in the White House. It's time to get the band back together.
Amen.
So then we played a show at the Bottom Line a couple nights there, and that was a live album.
And this is with Thule and Ed.
Thule and
Ed.
And
you and Colby.
Me, and Vinnie Leary, who was originally in the Fugs.
Okay.
Playing guitar. And then Mark Kramer on bass. And that was it. Yeah. Okay. And then that was it. We just kept going.
And when did Scott join the band? That was 2 years later?
It's a couple of years. Yeah. There was a couple of years there where we were playing with different bass players. But then Scott told me this story last night, actually. Ed was looking for a bass player locally. And somebody said, you know, call Scott. And that was that.
Do you know, sequentially, did Scott have his recording studio at that point, or is that
yeah,
much later?
Yeah, he did, because I met Scott at Hurley. He had his place in West Hurley.
That's right, okay.
So he was already in business as an NRS.
And he'd worked with the members of the band. I mean, he'd done a lot of things with folk singers, James Taylor, I mean, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah,
so,
many things. Yeah, yeah, many right. great artists. Yeah.
So he was a seasoned bass player by the time he joined the Fugs.
He's a monster, he's a great musician. Right.
And so how did you meet Scott?
Yesterday at Scott Petito's house.
I know that's not true. So is it a high-low meeting?
Yeah, I must have. No, I met him at 394.
Ah.
That's where I met Scott.
Poetry meeting?
Well, you know, he would hang out there in the mornings.
Oh, yes.
And the poetry.
Yes, okay. Great.
So that's where I met Scott.
Okay. Ross, how'd you meet Scott? Same thing?
Same way.
The coffee shop.
394.
Yeah, see, this is the local village scene here in Cassville. It's great.
Coffee in the morning.
Nice.
Yeah.
Cecil?
Yeah, I joined a group called Trapezoid. He came in with them, and he and Leslie played in the band, and that's how I met Scott.
Nice.
That was years ago.
So. Yeah. All right. Let's hear another song. You got one?
Yeah, I'll give you, this is Blake's Theology. It's just an A drone. Am I into the years?
Yeah, pretty close.
Okay, drone away. The Divine Image by William Blake. To mercy, pity, peace, and love. Oh, pray in their distress. And to these virtues of delight, return our thankfulness. Mercy, pity, peace, and love is God our Father dear. And mercy, pity, peace, and love is man his child and care. Mercy has a human heart, pity a human face, and love the human form divine, and peace the human dread. Every man of every clime that prays in his distress, prays to the human form divine. Love, mercy, pity, all must love the human form in heathen, Turk, or Jew. Where mercy, love, and pity dwell, there God is dwelling too. So God is in the, God is the imagination, is the imaginary form of the human, or the image of the human, or God, the human is in God's image, but that's all there is, baby.
Well, yesterday at Scott's studio, we were talking about a little bit, you were telling some stories, and one of them was about divine and divinity, and yeah. about divinity needs form.
Yeah.
Would you mind repeating some of that? That was fascinating.
Okay, so Blake was an engraver, and an old-fashioned, his teacher, Basir, was somewhat considered old-fashioned. So Blake learned a kind of old-fashioned style of illustration, but which suited his temperament. And he was, as you can imagine, as an engraver, his bodies, the bodies always have outlines. But his belief was that you have to have an outline because the body is a manifestation of spirit. And in order to understand it, in order to see God, he has to have a body.
He has to have form.
In order everything, in order for spirit to be understood, it has to have an outline. And that's related. And so in the Burroughs-Ginsburg conversation that I transcribed, they're talking about exorcism. And William and Alan related that Blakean notion of the body having or a form or spirit needing an outline to the Christian exorcism that the spirit has to have a name. You have to give it form in order to apprehend it. Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah.
So anyway. Your voice is so clear and pure. I have to ask you this. Do you exercise your voice? What do you do to keep it so...
I'm so out of shape.
Really?
Yeah.
But do you on a daily basis work with your voice?
No.
Something? You just sing when you sing?
No,
and that's
my
it?
Musical practice goes through cycles. It tends to be like I teach and I teach and I teach and I work on writing and stuff. And then, you know, I'll get a few weeks' notice and have to get my chops together.
It's so while you're teaching and other work, you're not necessarily... Not, practicing or playing every day for yourself?
No, I usually, my musical work when I'm teaching during the year is usually composing music for people who want things. So I'm not sitting there singing.
Okay.
I'm writing. Yeah.
Brian, what about you? What's your musical practice like?
Oh, gosh, I'm disorganized. Well, you know, depending on what kind of stuff you're doing, you know, I play zither, and so I've done a lot of stuff with the electric zither, which I used to drag along around much more than I do now, and a Leslie cabinet. But now I'm bringing the accordion around more, and sometimes electronic instruments, and the auto harp.
Do you structure a daily musical activity for yourself, or is it whenever?
No, I have a pretty irregular schedule, depending on what's on the front burner, depending on what has to be done immediately. Yeah.
Are you a night person? Would you describe yourself like that?
No.
Morning person?
Well, I tend to just naturally want to be up when the sun is up, and particularly the winter time when there's so little sunlight.
Right.
So left to my own devices, I'll get up with the sun. But if I'm around other people, then I stay up late because other people stay up late.
Ross, what about you? What's your musical practice?
Oh, gosh. I tend to practice my guitar for at least an hour a day, if not a couple hours.
At the same time of day, like in the morning? Or
usually around noon.
Uh-huh.
I usually do a few things in the morning, and have breakfast, and then practice my guitar.
And you play many instruments?
Yeah, I do.
I noticed you set in on the drums yesterday.
I practice them all. I mostly practice my guitar.
Uh-huh.
So you consider yourself a guitarist?
Yeah, primarily a guitarist.
A guitarist. Yeah. Cecil, what about you?
My music is, I don't know, it's strange because I basically more listen than I practice in a sense. I'm trying to listen to new things and that's how I create. So. Mm-hmm. So it's more like a listening thing, you know. And you know, when I do play, it's always with somebody. I mean, what I create is always with somebody else. It's never, you know, I mean, I do some stuff on my own, like looping and things like that. But it's mostly, you know, sitting in with other people.
So whose music are you listening to right now? What's...
Well, I like Yosa Ndour, some of the African music. I like really a lot of ska and soca, and you know, very world music is what I really like.
And rhythmic.
Rhythmic, very rhythmic.
Very rhythmic.
Stuff. Yeah.
Ross, what about you? What are you listening to?
I listen to a lot of classical music.
Yeah?
Yeah, lately.
Is there one composer that you're listening to a lot more than others?
I like Rachmaninoff.
Hmm.
Wow. That's heavy.
And is, do you see a direct inspiration for that in your own work?
Not really.
No?
I wish I could compose like that.
It's complicated.
No,
it's complicated.
Not at all.
Brian, what about you? Who are you listening to?
I like a lot of very varied things. And I even like to, you know, have a bunch of stuff that's dumped into a computer be on random shuffle so that different things will come up.
Mm-hmm.
But I do have a lot of organ music, and particularly kind of early 20th century organ music.
Mm.
Jean Alain is a composer I really love who's not well known but was a very big influence on me, but I think he's better appreciated now than he used to be, and he didn't live very long, but he wrote mostly in the 30s.
So you have a CD of Bells, and you were kind enough to give it to me, I think, when I first moved here. I listened to that all the time. I love that CD. What was the inspiration for the Bells? What is it about that spoke to you?
Oh, gosh. Well, one thing led to another where I started out doing a project where I was invited to write a piece for some musical stones that were in a museum in the north of England. And so it was supposed to be a, you know, something that several people could play or that people that don't read music mm-hmm. could play. But then we didn't have any takers. But I did make some music with Jamie Barnes, who worked at the Keswick Museum where the musical stones are. And then part of that instrument, it's kind of like a 17-foot long wooden frame with all these carved pieces of stone that are kind of slate that when you strike them, you know, resonate a little bit. And the instrument also had some iron bars on it, steel bars, and some Alpine bells. So the first track on that record are the Alpine bells from that instrument, and then of course the musical stones in that record are the what was called the Stone Harmonicon, which was built early in the 19th century. But then we were doing another musical stone piece later in Liverpool, and there was a children's Chinese orchestra, and they asked if I do a collaboration with the leader of the orchestra, which we did. And but while we were there, you know, there's the Liverpool Cathedral and the tower bells, and I really love change ringing. And I was thinking, like, oh, wouldn't it be great to do something with them? But, you know, how will that ever happen? But I spoke to somebody in the organization that brought me over, and they said, oh, the canon at the cathedral is very passionate about contemporary art. And then they hooked it up, and I did that project with the Liverpool Cathedral bell ringers, who, you know, normally what they do is change ringing.
Sure.
So what we did this time, it was different from what they're used to doing, but it was also, you know, very fluid, so it wasn't like there was some sort of,
nice.
You know, thing you can't keep track of that's difficult to execute.
Right.
So that was how I ended up getting to do the bells, and then I thought, well, darn if this is going to happen and it's not recorded. So I had a mini disc player, and I was sort of like a human mic stand with a stereo mic for a half an hour.
Well, I
on a little parapet to get the recording, and then as soon as it was done, I ran down the hill, and then we did the thing with the stones.
Oh, that's so cool.
The little street fair.
What a great story.
The street fair was set up at the end of a dead end, and at the end of the dead end was a parking area for a bunch of ice cream trucks. So there were ice cream trucks with trailers that were trying to back up, like right in front of the stage to get into the ice cream truck depot. So that was part of the street theater.
What a great story. So I will tell listeners, I will bring in the CD and play a cut from it so you'll have a reference for what we're talking about. It's a fantastic CD. Steve, who are you listening to? What do you listen to these days?
I don't really have time to listen to a lot of music. It's been to my detriment, really, that people say, oh, you're a musician. You're like, do you know this person? Do you know that person? I have no clue. I listen to myself. I listen to my musician friends. And I tend to binge on things. So there was a period in the 80s, for example, where I listened to John Coltrane's Love Supreme. That was the only thing I listened to, basically. Or classical music. But I would listen, you know, I would wear out records, you know. So I was never a big collector of music. But world music, yeah, I like it. At home lately, I listen to Indian music.
And what's the engagement for you on that?
To calm the demons. Yeah.
Did you give your demons a name?
Not yet. That's a good idea.
I want to know this. We should all name our demons. So quickly, before we... I want to play a little bit of the rehearsal yesterday, just because I think it has a unique flavor in itself. But what about the future of music? Anyone want to share what you think? Think about what's happening in music culturally, society. What are we going to be doing in 20, 25, 30, 50 years? Think of the technology. What do you think about the future of music, Brian?
You mean, what am I going to do, or what will music do?
Oh, either way. What are you going to do? Let's start there.
Well, because I don't know what music will do, and I'm not in charge. But, we'll have to see what the future brings.
Certainly the technology is going to change. Won't there be something similar like the iPhone camera with music in some way that people will become more...
But I don't even really
playful
think of,
with it.
I don't think of things being defined by an idea of technological progression. Mm-hmm. I mean, there are new things that appear that didn't appear before that end up being useful and part of the picture. But sometimes people think, well, it's so funny to see as time goes on. You know, when analog synthesizers were considered old news and digital equipment was new, people were very contemptuous of the analog devices instruments, and now they are revered as holy antiques, but for a while they were considered these contemptuously old-fashioned things, and so even the idea of, you know, that a technology will change and then everyone must, you know, lockstep with the new tyrant leader.
I was thinking about that yesterday in the studio when Ross was playing the Mellotron, and I was thinking about the history of the instrument and how at one point people must have thought, oh, no, that's not, you know, that's just like a technological, you know, toy or something. But now it's like awe-inspiring if it's used well. Mm-hmm. And you were doing some amazing things with it yesterday. See, so what do you think about the future of music?
Well, hopefully it's going to be, you know, getting people together. I mean, that's the only thing we can, hopeful. Mm. I feel like it's it really goes to show emotion and the human the picture of the human psyche, you know, through music, and hopefully it's going to come together. I don't know what will be happening in 50 years, but you know, I'm going to be playing as long as I can. So,
Steve, any final thoughts on that?
Well, one thought is. Jacques Attali, the economist, published a book some years ago called Noise, A Political Economy of Music, in which he said when major social change is about to happen, it shows up in the music first. Mm-hmm. And the extent to which a particular style of new music is prophetic of change is the extent to which people will say, that's not music, that's noise.
Ah.
And the name of that book is Noise. So I'm hopeful that the new music, the coming new music, will be prophetic of change and will teach us that there is change coming.
John Cage must have gotten the same sort of flack, I guess, in some ways at different times in his career. Well, I want to thank Cecil Hooker, Brian Dewan, Ross Goldstein, and Steve Taylor for coming in. They'll be performing along with Scott Petito tomorrow night at Hilo at 8 o'clock. I hope we can't do a call, but I hope that you'll enjoy going if you should decide to attend. We're going to end with a little bit of a rehearsal yesterday in Scott Petito's studio. Here we go. Thank you very much for
being
here.
Thanks, Robert.
It was great. Here we go. Waiting for the audio to come in. We're not getting any sound.
Well, we can always
play you out.
We can always play another one.
Okay, let's play another one. Let's just pause. Life would be better anyway,
Life is
right?
Strange.
Yeah,
Life
is strange.
We'll end that. All right.
This is Thule Kupferberg.
Thule, thank you.
Life is strange and death is easy. Diamond's heart is full of mystery. When will I know where the swallows go? I loved once, but now I'm lonely. Love, sweet joy for lovers only. When will I know where the sparrows go? Skies are green and fields are silver.
all gay hearts, they thrill and quiver. When will I know where the white doves go?